The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of the Taking a Walk podcast, Music History on Foot, join host Buzz Knight with a musician whose career defines longevity and excellence. Mark Rivera is the author of a new book, Sideman in Pursuit of the Next Gig, the story behind his amazing career, which has included a 40-year run as a sax player for Billy Joel. You'll hear amazing stories and inspiration from Mark Rivera next on Taking a Walk.
Well, Mark Rivera, it's so great to have you on the Taking a Walk podcast. Even though we're virtual, I feel like we're taking a walk somewhere in your backyard.
I wish we could be, telling the truth, especially after last week. You couldn't breathe in my backyard, but we're past that, thank goodness, right?
I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Well, congratulations on the great book, Sideman in Pursuit of the Next Gig. I love the book, and I love the themes of the book. In particular, gratitude. Can you talk about what gratitude means to you?
The most important thing in our lifetime is that we realize how blessed we are. I saw a wonderful, I think it was CBS Sunday Morning with Michael J. Fox, and here's a man writhing with Parkinson's disease, and Jane Pauley said something to the effect of, so what do you have? I mean, how could you keep so positive? And he said, if we have something to look forward to, we have something to be grateful for. And I have so much to be grateful for because, first of all, I have the greatest, in my opinion, I have the greatest gig any saxophone player could expect to have. I'm also Ringo's musical director. I have all these wonderful friends in this business. And most importantly, I have my family. That's the main thing I'm grateful for. Gratitude to me is just stopping, instead of getting on your knees and saying, oh, please give me, or I need it, it's saying thank you. That's this moment right now. There's so much to say thank you for. And so many of us are hung up on getting the next big house, the next Tesla, the next boat. I'm just happy as a clam to have my gigs and my family well around me and make new friends like yourself, Buzz.
Well, you're very kind. Another theme in the book is longevity. I think it's marvelous, the longevity in your career. What do you think the key to longevity is?
Getting along. Just getting along. I always make my position, especially as a musical director, make the analogy with a coach on a basketball team. I always say they have five guys on a basketball team. If I'm coaching five guys, I could go to one and say, hey, come on, man, Buzz, get it together, shake you a little bit. Where someone else needs to be coddled. Hey, Buzz, you know, you missed that layup, you know, we'll get it. In other words, everybody is an individual, and how you get along with each person is a separate entity. It's not like there's no cookie cutter that's going to fix relationships. As far as longevity, I mean, I just try to do what I do. I try to lift people up. My father, who's basically mentioned so many times in the book, he'd always say, never look down on anyone unless you're helping them up. And I try to live by that because you know, everybody thinks that they're better than or they're trying to achieve to get as good as. We're always comparing. I think longevity comes with your acceptance of your position. And who's a great coach? You'll say he's a great coach because he's your boy from the Patriots.
Bill Belichick.
Belichick, do your job. Three words, do your job. And if you think about it, if I go into a gig or any situation, do your job. Just do what's expected of you, which usually means be courteous to people, self-respect. I think that's what is a great deal of it. People don't respect themselves, and they just come out with, you know, guns flailing. So many times people have the answer to what they think is your question before they've actually listened. You know, and longevity to me, do your job and be conscientious of the people around you. That's pretty much it. Don't tick anyone off if you can help it.
Another theme in the book that's quite obvious is you're a tremendous storyteller. Who did you learn your storytelling from?
I don't know. All I know is I've been told that I have an incredible memory. I remember people's names for some reason, and when people ask me, how do you do that? I have no idea, but God forbid if the day ever comes that I don't remember and I start to freak out. I remember instances, I remember particular environments. I attribute a lot of that to, I'm mildly dyslexic, okay? So I don't read very well. In fact, I just did my audiobook, which was a real feat for me. I attribute a lot of my storytelling to my memory. I just, if I hear something, if you remember the line in when Paul Simon asked about the charts, I said, well, I think they're kind of lame. So I just came up with a line. I remember, I could play those horn parts today because I remember them. If I hear it, I remember it. So my recall is quite strong. So I remember stuff that I did. In fact, friends of mine from Brooklyn, they'll say, hey, man, how do you remember that stuff? I said, I don't know. Just, you know, we were on 39th Street. We were in a bowling alley. We played. We did our gigs. I remember what guys wore, the times, how they affected us. It's funny you asked that, Buzz. No one has ever asked me that, and I really don't, obviously don't have a real good answer, except that I seem to have pretty good recall. And that makes for, and for that matter, why let the truth get in the way of a great story, right? So,
we'll go back to that moment in the bowling alley, okay. Which I'm sure you could remember as if it was yesterday.
Yes.
Did you have tremendous butterflies at that moment, and do you still to this day have butterflies when you perform?
At the time, we were 13. It was 1966. No, 1966. The Beatles were on 64. I was 13. And we were getting, you know, the drummer Daryl and his brother Joel and my cousin Vinny, who was like, you know, unfortunately Vinny's passed away. But we would practice. And we get to the gig. And it was just a bunch of knuckleheads, four teenage boys wanting to play. And it was just a blessing. And was I nervous? Heck yeah. Mildly terrified at the time because the first time we played it, for, you know, up until that point, all we're doing is playing, I'm not your stepping stone, like, you know, like 1,000 times just for the four of us. Finally, there's like maybe, it might have been 12 people, but it might as well have been Shea Stadium for all I knew. And so that was unnerving. But to this day, people ask two questions. Do you get nervous before you go on? I said, I don't think it's nerves as much as it's excitement. It's adrenaline. And then other people ask the other question. Does it ever get to be like a matter of fact on the side of the stage of Madison Square Garden? I say, dude, if you're on the side of Madison Square Garden and you look around at 20,000 people and the buzz that's going on, if your heart doesn't get pumped up, check it, because you're not conscious. It's true that the adrenaline, the high of performing is tremendous, but I don't call it nerves anymore because we don't even rehearse with Billy at this point. In fact, I do a bunch of corporate dates and a bunch of gigs. I just did something for Breakfast with the Beatles yesterday. We got maybe 20 minutes to rehearse, barely, and it's five guys, but it's five guys who come in prepared. And it's like anything. Again, any great organization is run by somebody who knows to delegate to great people. Otherwise, you're going to find the weakest link and that chain will break. So it's pretty interesting how you go. I just think it's a matter of how much I love what I do, and I'm going to make it the best it could possibly be.
And you never take it for granted.
Oh, no. Well, that's, again, when you cannot do anything. I always say, I have never phoned in a gig. In fact, there was a club called Trax in the City, and it was a great rhythm section. A dear friend who passed away, Yogi Horton, was the drummer. Bette Sussman, tremendous talent. Whitney Houston, and she was Whitney's musical director. Tremendous talent. Jimmy Rip, who's Mick Jagger's MD. We had this band, and we'd back up all these different performers. And as it turns out, one night this guy comes up to me and says, hey, I want to take your number. Someday I might be doing something. I say, yeah, sure, I didn't think about it. 4 or 5 years later, I get a call from this guy, Jimmy Phelan, and he says, I want you to come to a recording session. I'm thinking, I hope it's not your wife, because she was not that good. As it turns out, because of that gig at Trax, and the guy hearing that, you know, again, it was a small club, and it was his wife or girlfriend at the time wasn't great, but we played really well, because that's how you do it. You don't phone it in. And because of that tenacity, or because of the pride that I take in my playing, the guy called me up, and that's how I got Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer. I got to play on Sledgehammer because of a gig that I did in this, I won't call it a dive bar, but it sure as heck wasn't Madison Square Garden. So it's, but that's, again, the approach. It has to mean something. If it doesn't mean something to you, geez, do something else.
You've talked about your formative years that really influenced you musically as being that year 1967 in
no
particular,
doubt.
Right? Tell me about, you know, the vibe and the music that was bouncing around in your head in 67.
Jeez, I'll give you a couple of examples, and I think you'll understand. In 1967, the Beatles put out Sgt. Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour. Jimi Hendrix put out Are You Experienced and Axis Bold as Love. Cream put out Fresh Cream and Disraeli Gear. The Rascals put out the Collections album. The Doors, Janis Joplin. It was all coming in, and it was at the time when DJs were allowed to play whatever they thought was cool, because a DJ, they were getting records all the time, and they'd play what they liked. It wasn't like, it wasn't the and not to knock programming now, but geez, they it's kind of like, well, this is what you're going to play today. You have a list of songs and stick to the program, which is all well and good for the monetary side of it. But as far as getting people to experience music, it doesn't happen. And in 1967, look, there were so many things going on. I'll go back a few years before that, in 1964, when the Beatles came out to the States in February. The preceding November, we lost John F. Kennedy. There was all this turmoil, and there was so much hate, and there was so much, young people were really disheartened. I mean, I remember my father practically in tears because of that. And then soon after, in 67, we lost Robert Kennedy. We lost Martin Luther King. So the music was a way that healed us. I was in 67, I was 14 years old. If I may say so, we were getting smoke a little bit of pot. We were finding, engaging in sex and having all these things. It was a great time. And the music reflected that. A band called the Moby Grape, unfortunately, put their record out the same day that Sgt. Pepper came out. And they had no chance, but they were still one of my favorite bands. I went to see the Moby Grape, but the guy, Skip Spence, had a bad experience with some drugs, so he had to cancel. And I got to see Cream, their first show at Fillmore East. You saw the picture of the Jimi Hendrix ticket. That's for real. I still have that ticket in my wallet. There was so much going on, Buzz, that I was able to take a train from Manhattan, from Brooklyn rather, into Manhattan. It might as well have been going like to Oz. Because kid in Brooklyn, you know, you have your friends, you play your games, you're playing stickball. All of a sudden, you get on the F train, you end up in Second Avenue in the East Village. Like, wow. Remember when in that part in The Wizard of Oz, when all of a sudden she wakes up and it's in Technicolor. It was a whole different world. 67, I will say to this day, it was the most fertile time in rock and roll music. I think in pop music in general. And we had just tremendous influences. You had Richie Havens singing protest songs. You had folk songs. You had Joan Baez. You had Bob Dylan, 63, 64, who my mom turned me on to. At the same time, you had the other spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you had psychedelia. You had Santana. You had all these great rhythm and blues, and Sly and the Family Stone, of course, was one of my favorite. And I'm not even talking about all the great R&B, the black sounds out of Detroit, out of Memphis, out of Muscle Shoals. And again, Muscle Shoals, I shouldn't say that because it wasn't a black, they were all white. But they played like in that swamp. I think you're familiar with that, right? So I could go on forever, but the short answer is, it was an unbelievable time. All you have to do is get a list of the Billboard Top 100 of 1967, and you'll say, wow. It was like a single week in 1967 eclipsed what would go on in a year at this point, in my opinion. Again, there's great songwriters still, but there's not the performers, I don't think, that we had then. You had to be. Some of these recordings were recorded with one microphone in a room, capturing 8-10 musicians. And if the trumpet was loud, they'd say, "What do you get to measure 63? Turn your trumpet face away from the microphone." You had to play with dynamics. You had to be able to have this cohesive group. And unfortunately, that's what I missed most of all: is playing with a group of four or five guys in a room and just getting into it. So I'm sorry if that took a long time to explain, but
it was an amazing time for sure. I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, so
okay,
I would take the train as well and head to the village. And I was influenced greatly by the radio. That's why I got into radio, listening uh-huh. to WNEW FM. I was fortunate to get to work there at a point in my career as well. And you're right, it had tremendous influence on how it curated for fans in a much different way.
Absolutely. In fact, you mentioned WNEW. I'm good friends with Dennis Elsa still and Ken Dashow. I mean, I'll tell you, we named our dog Roscoe because I remember Roscoe's tag. I do love you so. And he was the coolest DJ. I had my headphones and radio just transported me. It was so tremendous to have. It was such a vital part of my life. And FM was happening. You were getting album cuts. You weren't just getting the top 40 singles. It was exploding. It was great. So you know.
I have a listener of the podcast who wanted to ask a question. A gentleman by the name of Tom, who lives in the Philadelphia area.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted me to ask you, what do you think was the early fascination that the Philadelphia market had before really many other places had it with the song Captain Jack?
That'd be Ed Shockey. Do you remember Ed?
Yes, I do.
So, I mean, you can't even imagine how much of an impact one person could have. Here we are again. We're talking about what a DJ is allowed to do. Try to get somebody to play Captain Jack 12 times in a row, and if he didn't get fired, I don't know what the heck was going on. Ed Shockey took Billy on his shoulders. You know, the thing about Philadelphia, because people ask me, like, you know, other than, you know, Madison Square Garden, all these exotic places, where's your favorite city to play? I say Philadelphia. They say, why Philly? I say, Philly got soul. Philly's always had soul. Philadelphia, to me, two things. If they love you, they love you. But if they don't love you, they hate you. And it's like sports, like the Rangers and the Flyers or any rivalry with Philadelphia. You had this insane sense. But Captain Jack almost couldn't fail because of Ed Shockey. You remember Ed, of course, right?
I do, yes. I know Ed was an amazing trailblazer. And also one thing I always loved about Ed was Ed never saw a free hospitality platter backstage that he could never have his way with.
See, you're absolutely right. Ed enjoyed the backstage fair. I'm also, do you remember Mark Goodman?
Yes.
Okay, Mark and I are very good friends. In fact, I just did a Q&A that Mark hosted. Because Mark's out of Philly, right? Or just outside of Philadelphia. Yeah, I'm telling you, there's so much connection to this, I call it the Acela line. From Boston, I mean, I'll go up as high as Maine because I love Maine. But from Boston through Connecticut, through New York, to New Jersey, Philadelphia, Washington, that whole corridor right there, it must be something in the water, because it's how we connect to things. But yeah, I remember when Ed used to come backstage, he'd always have, you know, there'd be some mayonnaise. Oh no, we always go, you know, gotta get this. But he was such a sweet, sweet man, and his passion was boundless. He exuded like the enthusiasm, and he'd be talking, yeah, and it's like, well, you made your point, Eddie, but he was so into it. I can't remember his wife's name now, but she was always there with him, always, and that's the reason Captain Jack. I think that's the reason that Billy sustained, because they were ready to. I think they're ready to pass. I think Columbia or CBS, whatever they were close to, like, hey, we got nothing, and Ed Shockey, I believe, pretty much single-handedly turned Billy's career around.
Well, yeah, Judy Shockey, that's right, was his wife.
Judy, right.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, too, there was also a pivotal moment with a Sigma Sound live session that WMMR would play.
Billy. Right. Yeah. Again, I wasn't in that band. I wasn't in the band at the time, but I know what you're talking about. And it was that time, because I think that was like 78, maybe somewhere thereabout. Is that close to
yeah,
right?
That sounds.
Yeah,
right.
I joined the band. Yeah. The main thing is, it's when you believe in something and you when you hear something and it connects with you, it's this innate thing. It's visceral, because. It's like I always say about people say, what is it about the saxophone? I said, it's like, it's the closest thing to a human voice, because it's in you. And when a song comes into your psyche, into your being, people talk about like being Billy Joel fans and, oh, Billy Joel's song is a 3-minute snapshot of my life. Well, I go back a lot further than that. I go to Beatles songs, Beatles lyric. I remember, look, I want to hold your hand. It won't be long. Yeah, the first time I heard It Won't Be Long, I freaked out. My Aunt Iris bought me the record. It was just like it was a game changer. And I could hear some Beatle lyric. I remember being on the train, or on the bus rather, with my friend John Grado. We cut out of school. And I had my father's Toshiba transistor radio with the one earbud and listening in. And We Can Work It Out came on. I'm like, this is great. First of all, the song was tremendous because he had the perfect balance of Paul's optimism. Try to see it my way. We can work it out. Life is very short. There's no time for fuss. And that's John. John said, this is how it is. Stop putzing around and get hip to it. But Paul, their balance of the lyric was tremendous. So when something comes into you and makes that kind of, or has that kind of effect, it's tremendous. It's just tremendous because, I mean, there are moments in my life that I'll never forget. The first time in my grandmother's living room, listening to Meet the Beatles and then watching the Ed Sullivan Show, that is a pivotal moment in my life. Not unlike when I was accepted into high school performing arts. These are things that, you know, changed my life. I was 14. And I was going to high school and there was music, dance, and drama. There wasn't even a gymnasium in the school. It was that you went there to hone your craft. And those things were just tremendous to have that opportunity.
Tell me how you got connected with John Lennon.
I was in a band called Bump. It was actually called Community Apple. No, I'm sorry. Before it was called Dog Soldier, after a John Lennon lyric. My dear friend John Colbert was in a band. It keeps cycling back and back and back. I met John Colbert, the keyboard player. We did a jam session in Brooklyn, a bunch of friends. But my cousin Vinny, which is how the book starts, my dear cousin Vinny drove up to the Catskills, and I had already been, you know, I was with Sam and Dave, and I thought I made it, and then I fell. Oh, no, I was with Eclipse. We were with this band, and I thought I was a rock star because we were managed by Blood, Sweat, and Tears' manager. And then that went to crap. So finally, I'm playing in his Latin band, playing bass in a Latin band. No place you want to be, especially after you thought you were going to be a rock star. And we go upstate, and I'm playing boom, 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 bored to tears, and freaking out, saying, this is what my life has become. And I had a saxophone, and I got to sit in with this little combo. And the night before, I met this trumpet player, Bob Livingood, also, may he rest in peace. There's so many say that too often. And he heard me play, and he was impressed with my sound. So he said, yeah, you got to come down to the record plant. I'm in a 10-piece band, and I think you would dig it. So I'm like, yeah, okay. I didn't think much of it, but I got to play a little bit, so it took me out of the doldrums of the boom, boom, boom. So I finally got that. Fast forward maybe a half a year, Bob Livingood calls my cousin Vinny, says, hey, tell Mark if he wants to come up to the record plant. I'm like, yeah, cool. So we go there, and it was a tremendous band, 10-piece band. Vinny Appice, Carmine Appice's brother, played drums. It was just a powerhouse, four horns, two trumpets, trombone, and a saxophone. As it turns out, they were going to replace the saxophone player. And the only one who had heard me to that point was Bob Livingood, the trumpet player, and, of course, John Colbert. So I get in the band. Time goes on. And little by little, I knew John Lennon was recording in the studio because the guys in the band had already done some hand claps, I think, on Walls and Bridges. And my friend Jimmy Iovine from Interscope Records and a couple of other small endeavors in his life, he and I grew up in rival bands. So he said one day, he and Roy Sakala, who were the owners of the record plant, said, come inside, I'll do something. And I was literally cleaning the garbage. I was living at the record plant. And they invited me in little by little by little. And finally, John was about to do this tribute to Sir Lou Grade. And the band backed him. We did a couple of tracks. Most of it was lip sync, but we did get to play a couple of things with him. But it was just, again, it was another one of those Oz moments. I think I said in the book something to the effect, if I told you when you go through those doors, you're going to meet John Lennon. First we say, yeah, sure, sure. But once you do, there's no turning back. And what would you say? How would you act? It's like one of those hamada, hamada, hamada moments that you just don't know. You try not to step on your tongue, and you try to be cool, which is, again, part of longevity. Just be cool. I don't know what else to say, but that's how we got to work with John.
So tell me some horn players that really influenced you from the past, and any horn players of the present that influence you.
The horn players of the past would have to be Junior Walker, King Curtis. You know, I'm not a real jazz guy. I mean, I listened to my dad took me to see Sonny Rollins when I was like 7 or 8, or maybe 10. I'm sorry, I was about 10. He took me to see Coleman Hawkins' last performance. So those are tremendous sax players. And he'd have, you know, Just Jazz with Ed Beach. That was a radio station he used to listen to. WRVR, Riverside Radio. Okay, there you go. So my father used to tape this stuff really slowly, and it would last like the full hour on each side of the tape. So those are the guys. I would have to say Bobby Keys. Bobby Keys was a big influence because he was a soulful rock sax player. I'm not like a real chops guy. I'm not like a, but the guys who really impressed me with technique is, of course, Michael Brecker, David Sanborn, Ronnie Cooper, Barry sax player. But there's a gentleman who's playing now with Dave Matthews, Jeff Coffin, who used to play with Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. I don't know if you're hip to that. But he's just a tremendous player. And there are young players I just did a gig over last weekend, and this young kid, like 35, half my age, which is crazy, with a tremendous tone and a great attitude. This kid, Steven Salcedo, just a wonderful young player, vibrant. And I'd hear him playing, and I turn around and say, "That's great stuff." And he'd look over and goes, "Just trying to be like you, Mark. I'm just trying to be like you." And think, wow, what this wheel keeps turning. But those are the guys. I'd have to say there'd be more R&B. The guy, I can't remember the saxophone player who played on the Pink Panther. That sound on the Henry Mancini. In fact, the saxophone player, I think, got a piece of a royalty they gave him on that, which is tremendous to think about, a guy whose sound was so influential or so much a part of the song.
Mark, I think of you like an entrepreneur in how you sort of not only have your Billy Joel, you know, gig that you're so grateful for, but you have the other work, you know, with Ringo. You have the work you do on the corporate side, you know, to really sort of round out your work. Where did you get this entrepreneurial spirit?
In pursuit of the next gig, I guess. It's funny because people say now, how could you possibly be in pursuit of the next gig? So this has been going on for 50 years. From the time I was 13 was my first gig, but from the time I was like 18 all the way through, which is 52 years, I've been gigging and I've been playing with different bands, and you go through different cycles, and you try not to just stay stagnant. Playing with different people to me is the greatest thing. It's the greatest communication. It's entrepreneurially speak, if that's a word. I was always trying to create a situation for myself. I mean, there was obviously times when there was no work. Billy would take off for 3 years, and I had a hustle. I was selling life insurance. I was cutting trees down, and I think the main thing is that I learned from my father to never be above any situation. If your family needs to be fed, if you have people that you have to take care of, nothing should ever be below you. You should be happy to have the opportunity to provide. So that necessity being the mother of invention, you come out of that. I needed to do certain things, and I was not going to be let down. I was not going to let them down. It's pretty much how it went. And I, to this day, I don't think about it as an entrepreneur, but I guess, of course, you're right, Buzz. It's what I do. I go out and I hustle.
So let's play some word association or words association with some Billy Joel songs, if it's okay with you.
Of course.
Scenes from an Italian restaurant.
The word association, there's like a bunch of guys. We used to play, myself, Liberty, Russell, and David Brown used to sit in back while Billy would start the beginning of piano of Italian Restaurant. The scenes are like, you know, it's a proper piece of music with like a beginning, an intro, a release, a prelude, and then each one is a section. So these are different scenes. It's almost like you could be sitting in Brooklyn outside and you're looking around, you're sitting having a bottle of wine or some pasta with some friends. Oh, that's going on. Oh, there goes Brendan Eddy. Oh, you know, then 20 years later, these are the scenes that I think that Billy was evoking. At least that's what I get out of it.
Summer Highland Falls.
That's just him. He loves that area, Highland Falls. It's just, he just, the song itself is beautiful because it is about manic depressants. It's just high as a kite and low as the lowest doldrums you could think of. But most importantly, it's the ability to lift yourself out of those, out of that depression. Reasons covers this with our insanity. He's such a wordsmith. It's just his battle with his, probably his own, I won't say it's just depression, but we're all manic. We're all, hey, this is great. It's great until it's not. And then this sucks. It sucks until it's not, and it changes. So we constantly go through changes and we evolve. And I think the most important thing is, how do you cope? How do you get by day to day? What do you do? What are you going to do now? How are you going to remember the great Mike Tyson line? Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. You know, so we're all going to get punched in the face. So Summer Island Falls, one of my favorite songs.
One more here. This Is the Time.
My favorite Billy Joel song. My singular favorite Billy Joel song, because it says, these are the times to hold on to. So many people look back on their past or live for what might come in the future. This is the only time. Your presence in the present moment is the most important thing. It might have been Michael J. Fox again that said this. You can change your future by your perception of your past. In other words, your attitude at this present moment, reflecting on the past and accepting that, will change your attitude now, which in a sense will change what you feel going forward. But this is the time. Holding you close is like holding the summer sun. It's like I was a guest DJ on Sirius Radio, and I picked different songs, and that was I said, this is my favorite song. I said, and if I wrote the line about this beach is so cold on winter afternoon, but holding you close is like holding the summer sun. I said, if I wrote that line, I would have been done as a songwriter. And that's just one of the thousands of lines that Billy wrote. It just means so much. It's such a beautiful song. This is the time. Not that in the past and not what you're thinking about going for. This is the time to hold on to. It's the constant. He's always doing that. He's got this amazing ability to really play with you with the words. But the song is beautiful. And David Brown played such a beautiful solo on that. It's like Hendrix. In fact, the end of it is like the end of a Jimi Hendrix song. He'll say it, you know, that one and Easy Money. Easy Money is the end of Axe's Bold as Love. Easy Money. So Billy steals from the best, as he'll tell you. So.
Allow me to play word association right now. And I'm going to say Mark Rivera, and my word would be amazing.
Well, you're so very kind, Buzz. That's incredibly kind of you.
Thank you for being on my podcast, and thank you for all the joy you continue to give me and others. I appreciate it.
Buzz, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, and God willing, we'll keep moving forward. So we can do.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.